Welcome once again to our program, The Da Vinci Code Deciphered. This is our fifth session. We're trying to relate about this novel that was so famous, and a thriller and a page-turner, said by many millions of people who read it. But our great concern is that so many Catholics and Protestants were, I believe, rightly upset about the novel because it rewrote history claiming to be based on fact. So you can have a mystery thriller, and that's fine, but when you start taking the most important people in history, like Jesus, and maligning and changing the traditional understanding after 2,000 years of Jesus' place in the church and starting the church and his relationship to Mary Magdalene and to Peter and everybody else, then that's one of the reasons we're trying to decipher the Da Vinci Code and say a lot of these statements in the novel are based on historical people, but they're rewriting the whole history to make it come out in a way that Dan Brown said he wanted to challenge the customary long understanding of Jesus' relationship to the church, Mary Magdalene, and in history. So guest again is Ron Eldred, who teaches religion and history at John Paul II Catholic High. I'm your host, Monsignor Larry Moran, Pastor Emeritus, St. Patrick Church here at 19th and Poplar. Ron, welcome once again. We're going to talk now in this fifth session, and I think you've done some wonderful research on this, about the facts, or the fact statement that is at the beginning of the Da Vinci Code, claiming to have long and careful research in all the matters, even though it's just a historical novel, but it does have deep and accurate historical research. So can we say some things about the facts about the Da Vinci Code that they're claiming?
In this fact page, which is right at the very beginning of the novel, Dan Brown says that, quote, "All descriptions of artwork, architecture, documents, and secret rituals in this novel are accurate," end of quote. And that's a rather bold and arrogant statement to make, I think, by any author, let alone one who appears to have no credentials in artwork, architecture, documents, and secret rituals. Although the facts that Dan Brown uses to weave the story are new and creative to a lot of people, most of them can be found in other fairly recently published books. Amy Wellborn, who we quoted before in her book Decoding Da Vinci, that, quote, "What Brown has done here is weave a number of different strands of speculation, esoteric lore, and pseudo-history published in other books, cramming them all into the pages of his novel. If you're at all familiar with these other books, it's actually rather shocking how much in the novel is simply lifted from them," end of quote.
So that's from Amy Wellborn, who is a student of this whole Da Vinci Code.
Yeah, she's connected with the our Sunday Visitor.
Okay.
And she's written, I think, several books that they published. But I think she writes I don't know if it's a weekly article or editorial type thing for the our Sunday Visitor out of Huntington, Indiana.
She did considerable work on this book that you quoted.
It's one of the best of the several books, at least the 12, 15 books that were written by various scholars to refute, from a religious point of view.
Sure.
To refute.
And it's called Decoding the Da Vinci Code?
Decoding Da Vinci, I think.
Oh, Decoding Da Vinci.
Yeah, Decoding Da Vinci.
Okay.
Brown cites the books he uses for source material in the text of his novel, and some of them are the product of radical feminist scholars who have an axe to grind with the Catholic Church. Others are popular esoteric or occultic type histories. And among the books that that he cites, the authors, I'll name some of them, the Gnostic Gospels by Elaine Pagels, the Templar Revelation, subtitled Secret Guardians of the True Identity of Christ by Lynn Picknett and Clive Prince, another book, Holy Blood, Holy Grail. This is the one that's probably the best known, next to Elaine Pagels' The Gnostic Gospels. And this Holy Blood, Holy Grail is by three men, Michael Bagent, Richard Lee, and Henry Lincoln. And then the last series of books, The Goddess in the Gospels, subtitled Reclaiming the Sacred Feminine, Mary Magdalene, and the Holy Grail. That's all the title of one book. And a second book, written by the same author, The Woman with the Alabaster Jar. And the author of those books is Margaret Starbird.
So Dan Brown mentions that these are the source of many of his, much of his information.
Yes. Okay. Originally we thought about, looking at each of those, but then we found out that it would take a half a dozen sessions just to go into those. But if had we done that, you can easily see that that's where he gets his ideas. But we're going to be talking about the ideas anyway, so we thought that might be a little redundant to
try to
go into too much detail with their ideas. But I've seen almost all of these authors appear on several TV documentaries on the Da Vinci Code in over the last year and a half anyway. It would take far too long to review each of them, as I said a while ago, but they contain all or almost all of the misleading or erroneous ideas about the Catholic Church found in the Da Vinci Code. In fact, Brown has been sued by at least two authors for using their plots in his novel. What I would do, I would recommend that our listeners read any of the books that we have quoted in this series to find out about the false claims in these books. In other words, Meisel, Olson and Meisel, or Shea and Shree, or Amy Welburn, and Jenkins, and several others that we've quoted. You could go to their books and find refutations of the arguments in these books that Dan Brown uses as his sources.
So, as the question is often asked, where did some of these really strange ideas come that are in the Da Vinci Code novel? And that's why you're quoting that Dan Brown said, well, here's some of my sources. And that we would say the same thing about those sources, that they're very, very erroneous and misleading.
Yes, he didn't invent these ideas himself. He got them from these people here.
And sure.
And as I said, originally we had thought about going into it a little bit.
Well, I think he had 20 pages, didn't you?
Decided to leave that out because we're actually going to be talking about the ideas, but as Dan Brown uses them,
sure,
rather than they originally had used them.
Wonderful. Well, from a Catholic perspective, Ron, what is wrong with the Da Vinci Code?
Well, now we're getting down into the heart of soul of this whole series, why we're doing it. And I think the main thing that is wrong with the novel is that it mixes alleged fact and fiction with the intention of misleading, I think, the reader. Dan Brown promotes a New Age agenda through his characters, Teabing and
Princess Sophie.
Princess Sophie, Sophia Nouveau, and Robert Langdon, and those three characters. Carl Olson and Sandra Meisel, in their book, The Da Vinci Hoax, identify several major problems with the Da Vinci Code. One, it claims to be historically accurate and based on fact, but often it is not. Now, this is their...
That's their critique.
This is their critique
of what the problem is.
Number two, it repeatedly misunderstands or misrepresents people, places, and events. It especially rewrites and misrepresents church and secular history. Three, It promotes a radical feminist neo-Gnostic agenda. 4, it propagates a relativistic, indifferent attitude toward truth and religion. And finally, 5, it incorrectly and unfairly misrepresents Christianity and traditional Christian beliefs about God, Jesus, and the Bible. Now, what we'll do, we'll spend a little bit of time refuting the first 4, okay, but then the last one, the 5th one, there's about 6, in other words, the one, it incorrectly and unfairly misrepresents Christianity and traditional Christian beliefs about God, Jesus, and the Bible. We've got about 5 or 6 criticisms or claims that Brown makes about just that one, and then we'll spend about the rest of this of the series on that one.
Well, if I just throw in there, as you were talking about, it propagates the whole idea of the novel propagates a relativistic, indifferent attitude toward truth and religion. I thought of Pope Benedict the 16th, one of the opening statements he made shortly after he became Holy Father, or maybe it was shortly before, that the great problem of religion in the world today is we're under the dictatorship of relativism, and that relativism means that there isn't any truth. I make up the truth, you make up the truth, she makes up the truth, and whatever I believe to be true about religion, that's what the truth is. Instead of being something revealed, as traditionally we've always understood, by God that's put down in the Bible.
I believe that was in his inaugural address.
It wasn't?
As Pope, when he, relativism was, I think, sort dictatorship. Of the theme of his...
Okay.
The theme of his inaugural address.
Good. I just remember the phrase because it was, I thought it summarized the poison in the air today that we all breathe.
Well, John Paul had spent his whole career as Pope. I don't like to use the word career in regard to a Pope, but his vocation as a Pope, combating relativism. That's why he wrote books like Faith and Reason, Fide et Ratio, and other types of books.
So Benedict was just really kind of building on the many, many statements that Pope John Paul II had made through his wonderful time as the Holy Father. Well, explain what the author means, authors mean when they say in their criticism of the Da Vinci Code that it claims to be historically accurate and based on fact, but often it is not.
As Olson and Meisel tell us, many historical fiction writers, they take some liberties with facts, what we might call poetic license. The intent of those who take such liberties is usually not malicious, but rather is often intended to help the plot flow or to help facilitate character development. In other words, the historical background has changed a little to help make the story more interesting. However, Olson and Meisel claim that the Da Vinci Code is not strictly speaking an historical novel. And I got thinking about that too. One of our shelves in a classroom, which I taught several classes earlier today, the high school here, the John Paul II Catholic High, and I saw the book Quo Vadis. And Quo Vadis, of course, was a, you know...
Sienkiewicz.
Yes, and this book was won the Nobel Prize for Literature back a number of years ago. And it's a historical novel. And it's a historical novel of the time of Nero and the Christians. And I believe, if I recall right, Quo Vadis, the Latin, I think Peter was leaving the city of Rome when the persecution was going on, and I think Christ appeared to him. I think that's how the story
That's it, sure.
And I think Christ said, what, Quo Vadis?
Where are you going,
Where are
Peter?
You going, you know, Peter?
And he was on his way back to Jerusalem.
He was trying to escape his martyrdom.
Right.
And so he went back, and that was the year 67 A.D. He was crucified upside down and killed in the forum there, the circus, the Colosseum had not yet been built, so it was in. It would have been in the
circus.
So
your point, I think, is well taken, that Quo Vadis is a historical novel, but it really is based on historical facts.
The fact, you can get a lot of history from
it.
Oh,
my, you can learn a lot.
You can take it to the bank. In other words, it's accurate. It's something
very
worthwhile
accurate about
depositing.
Nero. And this is the problem with the Da Vinci Code. It claims to be a historical novel, but the history often isn't history at all.
Well, as I read it, it's really not an historical novel in the sense of the, you know, Quo Vadis, for example.
Sure.
That's what made me think of Quo Vadis.
Yeah. Well, and Quo Vadis was made into a powerful movie.
Yeah, oh, yes, it was. Yes, Robert Taylor and I think maybe Deborah Carr were the...
Oh, you're getting to be a movie reviewer.
Well, there was.
I couldn't remember.
Saw those 50 years ago, probably, or 40, 50 years ago. So, again, Olson and Meisel claim it's not, strictly speaking, an historical novel, but that it is unique because its historical claims are the central focus of the novel. They are, so to speak, the real characters and plot, rather than the mystery, the murder mystery that goes through the
which
novel.
Apparently is fascinating to many people, but the underlying substance of the thing is it's really not based on history at all.
I think it's fascinating to people because they like a lot of this stuff we're talking about right now and trying to refute, rather than any fascinating mystery. I didn't find it a very, at least personally, a very interesting mystery at all.
So you read it in order that we could discuss it on the program.
Yes. It was penance.
Okay.
Fortunately, it had real short chapters.
Okay.
Around, I don't know, 100 of them or something like that. So only each chapter was only 2 or 3 pages at a time. So I could usually just about take 2 or 3 chapters at a time.
Well, obviously, your experience was different than millions of other people.
I know it was. And, of course, I was looking at it from a critical point of view.
Well, sure, the history that you know and the faith that you know.
Sure.
And it would be disturbing, I think, to a person who knows how much error is actually propagated, particularly about Jesus, the most important person in my life. That's why I really am glad to be on this program, because I want to do anything to defend my friend Jesus from all this, I would say, blasphemous statements in the novel.
Well, Olson and Meisel, they say, a little quote here, quote, "A serious reading of the Da Vinci Code reveals that the characters are simply devices meant to help promote Brown's central concerns, which are ideological. Without its radical rewriting of historical fact, Brown's novel does not exist in any shape or form," end of quote.
Read that last quote again, because I think that's the heart of the matter of the criticism from Catholics and Protestants that have come.
"A serious reading," quote, "a serious reading of the Da Vinci Code reveals that the characters are simply devices meant to help promote Brown's central concerns, which are ideological. Without its radical rewriting of historical fact, Brown's novel does not exist in any shape or form," end of quote. I guess that's what I was kind of trying to say a while ago. There's really not any real plot to it, hardly. It's all this other stuff in there that I think that a lot of people, for reasons we'll get into later in some of our later sessions, why they find this stuff fascinating.
So alluring and attractive.
When you get things like Gnosticism, the kind of Gnosticism that's in it and things like that.
So it's actually talking about the sacred feminine Gnosticism, the falsity of the Catholic Church for centuries. Those are very popular ideas floating around in our society today. And we'll talk about those when we get there.
Yes. Okay. Recall that we discussed earlier in this series Brown's so-called fact page, which has come up several times.
And that's in the front of the book.
That's in the front of the book. And I've read that he insists in interviews that his book is thorough and accurate in its representation of events, historical personages, and in beliefs. But Olson and Meisel and numerous other critics point out this simply is not the case. As they show in their books in lots of detail, far more detail than we'll ever be able to do in this series. Considering the sort of claims Brown makes, historical accuracy is a major issue with his novel. And don't forget how historically unreliable were Brown's sources that we briefly discussed earlier. As I said, we didn't take the time to actually go through the books and then the refutations of those books before Brown ever used them as sources. Okay. But there were numerous critiques
made of those books,
of those books,
that he used as historical.
That he uses
and
historical.
And the critiques were that the books were not historical.
Yes.
All right, what does Olson and Meisel mean when they say the Da Vinci Code repeatedly misunderstands or misrepresents people, places, and events, that it rewrites and misinterprets church and even secular history?
Although we will later discuss some of Brown's misunderstandings and misrepresentations in detail during this series, I'll provide a few of Olson's and Meisel's examples to make the point. For example, Brown confuses the Vatican and the Catholic Church. He writes as if though they were synonymous, frequently referring to the Vatican and the place of the Catholic Church. Brown claims that Constantine created a new Vatican power base, for example, which is an amazing feat considering the fact that that in his day, the Vatican didn't even exist back in Constantine's day in the 4th century.
Okay.
In fact, it was just a swamp, actually, a swampy marsh. Nonetheless, Brown has his fictional character, the historian Lee Tebing, stating that the Vatican was the official residence of the Pope until the 14th century.
Okay, so the Vatican came about then when Italy took over the Papal States and created that 1 mile square inside of Rome. That became Vatican City and the country of
that
Vatican.
Would have been in the 19th century, mid-19th century, of course, during the nationalistic period of Italy, when it was being formed into a country under people like Garibaldi and people of that sort.
Okay.
Another example of Brown's misuse of the facts of history is his maligning the Catholic organization Opus Dei, which we looked at not too long ago. We dealt with that issue at least on a couple of different stations. Olson and Meisel state that the Da Vinci Code depicts other people and groups in a dubious range of ways, including Mary Magdalene, Emperor Constantine, Leonardo da Vinci, whom we've already looked at, the Knights Templar, which we already looked at, and the Priory of Sion, which we already looked at. They say that this shouldn't surprise us, since in his previous novel, Angels and Demon, Brown plays loosely with the facts of history and portrays the Catholic Church in a highly negative light.
All right, now when you said that their complaint was that the Da Vinci Code novel depicts other people and groups in a dubious range of ways. Help me with that phrase, a dubious range of ways.
Well, just a false, making false statements about them.
Okay.
And we've only gave two here in regard to the question you just asked. We could, you know, there could be dozens of others that he's made in the book. And we will come to some of those later on.
Okay. What do Olson and Meisel mean when they say the Da Vinci Code novel promotes a radical feminist neo-Gnostic agenda? That's a mouthful.
Yeah, that's a subject we're going to spend 4 or 5 sessions on later. But right now, I'll just sort of give a brief summary. According to Olson and Meisel, it might seem unimportant to some readers that the major themes in the Da Vinci Code are the sacred feminine and goddess worship. But many fans of the novel consider them a serious matter. They say that, quote, the past few decades have witnessed a rapidly growing interest in these topics, and that interest has influenced political and cultural opinion about sexuality and morality. As Philip G. Davis explains in Goddess Unmasked, The Rise of the Neo-Pagan Feminist Spirituality, now I'm still quoting them, and I've read Philip Davis's this book.
Okay.
They're quoting Davis now. Goddess spirituality makes dramatic claims about anthropology, archaeology, ancient and modern history, social organization, psychology, art, and human biology, as well as religion. End of quote. Now, Olson and Meisel claim correctly, I believe, that much of its inspiration of the Da Vinci Code derives from goddess spirituality. Again, they refer to Davis to prove that, quote, the goddess involves a mixture of neo-paganism, neo-Gnosticism, Wicca, which of course that's another word for witchcraft, occultism, and radical feminism, all of which are mentioned at least in passing within Brown's novel, end of quote. And then they go on to quote Davis again as saying regarding goddess worship, quote, it is perplexing that claims so easily disproved are nevertheless in wide and increasing circulation. An important lesson of this book is the ease with which patent falsehoods may clothe themselves in the garb of scholarship and masquerade as truth, end of quote. We'll have quite a bit to say about the sacred feminine and goddess worship later on.
Okay, but that is a highly volatile subject in our society today. What about?
Well, and it's the main theme of the Da Vinci Code.
Okay, let's take one more step. What do Olson and Meisel mean when they say the Da Vinci Code propagates a relativistic, indifferent attitude toward truth and religion?
Well, one of the great dangers of popular entertaining work such as the Da Vinci Code is that it reinforces the relativistic attitudes that are already prevalent in Western society, Western culture. And it offers additional reasons for readers to embrace such attitudes. Relativism is the view that truth is relative and may vary from individual to individual, from group to group, or from time to time, having no objective standard. An example of cultural relativism, which claims that different cultures have different but perfectly legitimate and equally valid standards of truth and value. Relativism is often just another word for subjectivism. And by subjectivism, I mean an ideology or philosophy that holds that only valid standard of judgment is that of the individual. For example, ethical subjectivism holds that individual conscience is the only appropriate standard for moral judgment. Those holding this view believe that there exists no objective standard of right or wrong outside the individual mind. Truth is believed to be nothing more than opinion of individuals. Pope Benedict, as we said a little while ago, he believes that our biggest enemy is moral relativism, the belief that there exists no objective moral standards or absolutes, and something is right or wrong depending on time or place or circumstance or situation, relevance, consequence, context, those kinds of things.
So, if I think same-sex marriage is okay, it's okay. If you don't think it's okay, it's not okay. Each of us just makes up our mind about it. If I think abortion is okay and you think abortion is a terrible thing, well, we're both right because right and wrong are dependent upon the individual.
Let me kind of close this with a quote from James Hitchcock, a professor of history at St. Louis University, quote, millions of people read the Da Vinci Code not because they necessarily believe its absurd story, but because it creates a myth that serves certain emotional needs and allows them to be religious without submitting to any of the demands of faith. End of quote. And reacting to Professor Hitchcock's comment, Olson and Meisel make reference to remarks made by Robert Langdon, who talks about faith as being built upon fabrication and beliefs that cannot be proven in any way, end of quote.
We've come to the end of our time, Ron. Thanks so much. May God bless you always and in all ways.